welcome, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and we are happy that you are with us today. I hope you had a good day so far. If you want more radio, we have a couple of websites for you, redeyescreations.com and redeyesradio.net. And of course, for our members, if you want to have access to all our programs, both ours and all the videos, TV shows, and extra material, redeyesmembers.com is the place for you. Well, today we have Mike Cross with us. He's the author of the Freedom from Conscience book series that discusses psychopaths and their relationship to politics and how they manipulate society and personal relationships. Mike is a former Oregonian now living in Stockholm, Sweden, teaching psychology and international finance. We'll start to talk about psychopathy, societal control by the elite, and how to break away from the conformity that has Western society in its grip. Welcome back, Mike. How are you today? It's great to speak with you again.
Oh, well, it's great to be back on the show again, Henrik. Yeah, things are great. Hope they are with you, too.
Yep. Well, a lot of things to worry about, that's for sure. We're trying to do the best we can to awaken our people, our folk, to the very basic suggestion that the elite and the people in charge of this world does not have our best interest at heart. And there certainly is no lack of work to do in that department. So, but anyway, we'll get into that later, Mike. But maybe you could just briefly tell us about some of your work. You've written, you're currently writing a series of books called Freedom from Conscience, about psychopathy. Tell us a little bit more about your work for those who are not familiar with it.
Okay. Well, first of all, I would strongly encourage people, if they want, you know, very specifics, not to go to my webpage, and they can find that at michaelcross.net. And I put up references in regards to the books under published works, and also make social commentary. So you'll find everything from articles on conformism to Edward Bernays to psychopathy. The books themselves, though, they follow an anti-hero narrative in which a young woman who has a lot of the traits that we associate with psychopathy becomes, well, in the first book, somewhat of a vigilante serial killer, kind of like the character Charles Bronson portrayed in the Death Wish series of the 1970s, someone who goes out and tries to right in society's injustices. The second book follows that same line, although it goes a little deeper into the psychology of relationships, especially modern relationships. This is not just a psychological thriller series that deals with, you know, just someone going out and narrowly escaping problems and committing crimes to bring justice. It also deals with various themes. And the first one deals a lot with someone who does not want to conform into a society that, you know, she finds herself in public school. And in the United States today, the society has so gone into conformism. I don't even hear people talk about the rugged individual anymore in the United States. It seems that it's more of a societal conformity, and that can be very overwhelming to those who think differently, psychopaths and non-psychopaths alike. The second book, of course, goes into relationships, and I touch on some things that, you know, we could talk about later in regards to how the society seems to be smothering when it comes to the idea of marriage and family and traditional values. And so that is a subplot within the plot of that book. The third book takes the character away from the comfort zone. You know, it's set in Portland, Oregon. And by this time, the character is living a very unique suburban existence. People would have to read the book to see what I mean by unique. But she is kidnapped, and that book is The Freedom from Conscience, Deliverance from Evil. She's kidnapped by someone who reads one of her works through her university dealing with psychopathy, and he kind of likes what he sees and wants to make her like an apprentice. He's got a vendetta against God, so he commits murder in order to show that he's in charge and not God. And of course, he doesn't realize through the brainwashing that he attempts to do and so forth that the person that he has that he's trying to shape is, well, someone who has experience in serial killing themselves. And so there's this underlying tension. But in that book, I start interweaving politics because he's also someone who the villain is someone who believes that society is going to collapse, that everything's going to fall apart. And he's preparing for this, kind of like Charles Manson, you know, how he was in the 70s. He thought there'd be this big race war, and that in the end, the survivors would come to him and his family to rule the society because they wouldn't be able to rule it on their own. They would need him. And so this character is patterned after that. And of course, then as time progresses, then I start interweaving the idea that can you really get rid of the spark of individuality? And so that's where the tension and, of course, a psychological thriller, you have to have a lot of tension. That's where that comes into that one. Now, the fourth book, which is not out yet, the publishers asked for it, and I haven't sent it in to him yet because I was just getting everything together, would be called Descent into Darkness, Freedom from Conscience, Descent into Darkness, in which by this time the main character has been elected to the state legislature of Oregon. And of course, I throughout lots, you know, our last two interviews we had, I point out there's a real strong connection between psychopathy and politics. I mean, the two go hand in hand quite a bit. And of course, she's a politician, and then her family and herself are threatened because she takes on the issue of sexual slavery, you know, where people import, you know, kidnap or trick women from Eastern Europe and put them into the sex industry. And then she has to essentially go undercover in order to eradicate the threat. The fourth book will get you more into politics. This corruption to the CIA being involved in setting up various nasty organizations, maybe to undermine the Russians and so forth. And so it gets a little bit more into the intrigue. And I will point this out, which is kind of funny. Some of the main bad guys in this I listed as being part of the Chechen mafia has nothing to do with the Boston bombing. I had the rough drafts already done, and then that happened. So right. Don't think that I copied anything from that incident. It deals with basically someone having to sacrifice pretty much everything in order to protect their family, and in the process discovers that just how deep police corruption and government corruption really go. At the same time, she's being prodded into possibly running for the United States Congress. Of course, I'll have to wait for the fifth book there. But essentially, yeah, that's the theme of the books. They all have a philosophical bent to them, but they are also an evolving political intrigue, you might say. And I think the fictional narrative is easier for people to understand the way that, for instance, psychopathy works, but also how the real world works. I mean, we are a species that up until recent years, we learned about ethics and values and storytelling from the elders and of whatever group, wherever you lived. This is how we learned about life, was through storytelling and mythology, and and literature has a way of being able to speak to people that a textbook on politics in America or the world today, or even, you know, something like Machiavelli's The Prince or psychology books or whatever could not do. It I think that literature has a way of being able to communicate in a way that people can go, wow, that's the way it really is, isn't it?
Well, exactly. I think people, it's both a positive and negative thing, I guess. It's more difficult for some people to be more just objective and kind of look at the big picture. They need to connect with the character. They need to be really close into the story to be able to kind of understand. And really, that's a way for people, of course, how they empathize with people, which is one of the methods that the psychopaths lack. So ironically, I guess that's a good delivery method then.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people have a hard time. I think this is one of the number one weaknesses. It's a strength in a sense when it comes to binding our society together, but it's also a weakness that we think that other people think exactly the way we do.
Yeah.
And that is not true. I mean, that is absolutely not true. Of course, in some circles, especially during the 1970s when behaviorism was really big, that would be very politically incorrect to say. But the more that we're seeing how people are basically, they're born with certain traits, certain personality predispositions, and the environment can help to mediate there, but it cannot change the individual. Now, that's the, we're learning that more and more and more, but in the process, we have to understand that everybody is different. It's just that some people, we cluster. It's like if you look at hair color, well, that person's blonde, that person's brunette, that person's a redhead. But of course, there's variations within that. And just because one person has red hair doesn't mean they look like another person that has red hair. It's just that we tend to, when it comes to personality, we cluster in the same way. You and I may have similar personality traits, but perhaps I have something that maybe is so far into another area, perhaps being Asperger or schizotypal or borderline, that would help define me as an individual as opposed to another person. And that's what personality or disorders are all about. We all have a little bit of psychopathy in us. We all really do. It's just some people, that's their predominant way of seeing the world. And that is a way of seeing the world that's very, very low when it comes to empathy, remorse, guilt. Some people would say that's a strength. And that's why I actually title the books, Freedom from Conscience, because the character sees this as a strength. You can do something, you don't feel guilty for it.
Yeah. It seems to me anyway that I feel that the agenda that we have today is really prying on our guilt, on our empathy, our good intentions, our humanity, if you will, that we feel so much for others that we are, we're willing to sacrifice portions of ourselves to give this up. It's a kind of a masochism ultimately if you don't kind of have that survival instinct within you. But I guess that would be the opposite of the psychopath, which of course can be, as you say, very, 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 very detrimental. Our guilt is such a powerful marketing tool. They discovered that this is one of the main, drives how parents give up power to their children, for example. So this has been studied for a long time, and guilt is a major issue that I think we need to tackle better, Mike, if we are to kind of take control of the political system again. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you take a look at, there's things I happen to, I know a lot of times in alternative media that, Sigmund Freud is demonized, and I can see why in some respects, but I think to a large degree, as opposed to his nephew, Edward Bernays, Freud was somewhat what I would call neutral. He just came up with stuff, but he didn't apply it on a mass scale himself. It's just people that came along after him used it, but he did write in his book, or I should say booklet. It's not really a book, but it's also bigger than an article. It's called Civilization and Its Discontents. And I would say that's one of those must reads that are out there, regardless if someone agrees with Freud or not in general. And in it, he actually did state that guilt was what held society together. It's what causes us not to want to go out and do something bad to other people. But he also said that it hampers the individual, because you feel like if you have you know, bad, if you do something bad to someone, or you encroach on them, that you've done something really wrong. And it could be like, let's use an example. You're in a real hurry and you need to get out of the store real fast and you had to buy something. Let's say your wife has a migraine. You rush to the store to get some sort of medicine for her, and you're in a hurry to get back home so she can have the medicine and get rid of the migraine. But you see that there's someone walking towards the line too, and they have a big shopping cart full of things, but you know, they have a couple kids crying and so forth, but you still jump ahead because you don't want to wait for so long. At the same time, you feel, you know, you just feel like it's going to take you quick. But most people will still feel that, oh my gosh, you know, I rushed, she could see me rush in front of her, and they feel bad about taking, kind of pushing into the line and getting ahead of this person. The psychopath doesn't feel that. I would note they yep. would at least make up some justification for it. But most people, guilt will lay on them and they feel it continuously. And the people that actually run the show, you know, the people that we often nowadays call the 1%, I would actually say it's the 1% of the 1% who really run society. As Edward Bernays, Freud's nephew, did point out, we're dictated to by a small group of people that we do not even know who they are, who are behind the scenes, that decide our fashion, our hairstyles, and our values. And they have the power to do it through education, through media, through all sorts of means. And since they know that we have guilt, they can use it to sell us a variety of products on TV, but they can also sell us ideas, which may be detrimental to us in the long run if we adopt them. But they can also sell us politicians. I would say nowadays selling a dozen donuts or selling a politician, no difference. It's still using the same ideas of Freud. People are motivated by irrational desires, sexuality, security, those kinds of things. If you ask them, they will deny it, but it's because they feel uncomfortable admitting to it. But the advertiser knows what gets them. That's why they used to have focus groups. And yep. really they ask, I mean, they still do have focus groups, but in the 50s, they get housewives together and sit them down and start asking them questions to find out, you know, how they wanted to bake a cake in an oven. And what they were really looking for was what the pan would symbolize to them psychosexually, so that they could so they could better use that knowledge to show those kinds of pans with their cake mix in the ad, so they'll buy the product. And this happens, and this still goes on. There's still psychiatrists out there that work on these things. You know, I was watching a program, and this is what bugs me. Sometimes I don't feel as bad when I see adults manipulated, but when children are manipulated, I really, really resent that. And there was a documentary called Consuming Kids. You can find that on YouTube if it hasn't been pulled. And they talk about these researchers that follow little kids around, like 3 years old, 5 years old. The marketers are divided. Well, I do 2 to 4, and I do 4 to 6. And that's their marketing area.
Yeah.
And they watch what appeals to the children, and then they will use that to sell them on toothpaste and bubble bath and all of these kinds of things. And I mean, I think ultimately it takes a little bit of psychopathy to be sitting there thinking, how do I manipulate a 3-year-old into nagging their mom to buy this cereal over that cereal?
Oh yeah. Yeah. it's really wicked. It's just amazing how it's turned into this kind of machine, really, consumerism. But I wanted to ask you about something before we proceed on that note. I don't know how deep into we want to get here, but the mechanisms of guilt, if this is, in your view, predicated on well, reality, shall we say? I mean, are the morals that we feel guilt of breaking the moral codes, are they, do you think, externally dictated to us so that it can be someone can come along and kind of instill within us what these morals should be? Ergo, this is a way, of course, they very much could manipulate us then. Or is the guilt somehow kind of inherently just in us, a moral code? I don't know. What's your view on that, Mike?
Well, my view is this. The idea, first of all, I'll just point out, again, people that have high levels of psychopathy, even the ones that don't actually score enough on like the hair checklist, they don't score 30, or I think in Britain it's 25, they might score 20. They still have these traits, and often they do not feel very much guilt at all. And some people know guilt, but a lot of these people feel a little tiny bit, but not very much. But most people, 98% of people, do feel guilt. But I think guilt is something that is, how do you put it? It's a very general thing. And then we, as time goes on, we make it more specific. For instance, if you're a little child, a little girl, for instance, and you're, I don't know, you're like 4 years old, you're 4 years old, and your mother makes comments to you that the clothes you're wearing are not appropriate when it comes to going out into the store. Now, you will look at that at first and think, well, why not? But then you start feeling like, okay, I want to please my mom. But then her saying that to you will give you this lesson that not just you, but other people should feel guilty if they go to the store dressed in whatever clothing that you had on. And you will also apply that in different ways in your life. And therefore, if you, for instance, later you have to, I don't know, you belong to some club and you've got to pose in a dance uniform or something, you will feel perhaps guilty when you get in front of the camera. Now, that illustrates how I think guilt operates. It's very general when mom says, well, that's not good to do. And of course, I think what is ingrained in us is that we want to please our parents. As I know it sounds very Freudian, but I think it's valid. We want to please our parents. We don't want the negativity because that gets associated with the loss of love. And so then that gets ingrained in us. And then as we get a little older, you know, your parents are saying, well, you should listen to your teacher. You should listen to the policeman. You should do these things. And we incorporate those things in, again, innately, we want to fit in. We want to be part of the tribe, per se. But at first, the family and then the tribe, and then that gets projected onto the community. And the disadvantage is that these are things now that are very deep in our subconscious. They're hardwired. And then you can play on them. Now, I've seen situations where, for instance, you might say that a lot of times you'll see someone come on TV and they'll be saying, well, look at this, these victims of this or that or whatever around the world. You know, we need to help them. Now, I think a lot of that's going to be depending on how your parents did. Like sometimes I'll see parents walk by a beggar, for instance, and, you know, the kid stops for a second and the parent will just say, hey, come on, let's get going. Versus another parent that's like, here's some money. Why don't you give this to the beggar? Now you've taught the child that, well, this is something that maybe you should do. Now, the thing is, I'm not saying you should or shouldn't. I'm just saying that you've given a lesson here. The first kid's more likely to probably not feel so much guilt when someone says, well, we need to taxes to help these people. The second child has been taught this lesson because mom has said, here, give this money because this person is less fortunate than we are, has been taught a lesson that to please their mother, they should do nice things for people that are less fortunate. Now, maybe they should. Okay, I'm not making any value judgments there. But that second child, when they are adults and there's a political party saying, hey, we need to help the poor, and that means we got to raise taxes. So everyone needs to make some sacrifices here to help the poor. They're going to be more likely to feel guilty if they don't. And so therefore, they'll gravitate more towards liberal or left politics, whereas the first child will gravitate more towards, you know, more the conservative side. So I'd say that's how guilt works. It's a very general thing, but then we extend it and project it onto scenarios that are related to it. So it can relate to what we wear, what we eat. You know, if mom was a vegan, you know, you may feel guilty if you eat meat, whereas most kids don't think anything of it.
Yep, exactly. Now, is this if we are manipulated by these things and we realize that it's something which is not beneficial to us, how easy is it to break out of that and to break those values that has been instilled in you? Is that something that's going to then plague you? That you, I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of, you know, it could even be, let's say, something which is commonly known or commonly accepted, let's say, morally, and then people who attempt to go against that because they know ultimately down the road this is the right way to go, but it's tremendously difficult to go against that because it's, well, as you said, everyone wants to fit in, no one wants to be hated, everyone wants to be loved, basically, right? But is it, how can we break out of that, do you think, if it's something that ultimately is detrimental to us?
Well, first of all, I would say, for instance, I like that quote from Nietzsche where he says something to the effect of, and I'm paraphrasing, that it's difficult to go alone and to go against the tribe. But for those who do, they will gain their individuality and their own self-respect. And that's usually the first realization that we need to do those things. It was interesting. I was actually interviewing someone on psychopathy who actually is diagnosed as a psychopath. But they pointed out that often it's the psychopath who, when they go to a party when they're teenagers and everyone's saying, hey, let's get stoned or let's drink and stuff like that, they're often the ones that say, no way. You know, or their friends are all sleeping around. They're like, no, that's not me. You know, so they can actually be the ones that are more, you know, moral in that respect. But it doesn't bother them to break the norms of whatever society they're in. That could be good and bad. The other thing, though, is that often, and I think it's very crucial that in some way we connect to other people who share our values. That's one of the things I think alternative media has done tremendous work in helping people to become more individualistic and stand up for themselves, because at least they feel like there's other people out there besides them. But I think we have to, as human beings, we still have to connect to other people. So if we want to, you know, for instance, go against globalization, get together with other people that are trying to set up local avenues of getting of obtaining food. You know, if you want, especially in America, oh my gosh, you know, everything's GMO. So it's really difficult to do that. So you might have to get together with people and say, how are we going to go about this? How can we make connections to farms and livestock producers and those kinds of people? And then we can go do it. So you're bucking the system. And it's difficult. But ultimately, you have to do that. But maybe as crucial as that is, you have to actually become aware of the system itself. It's like with the Matrix. You got to take the pill. I forget which one now that he took, the blue or the red pill.
I think it was the red, right? He took the red pill.
He took the red one. Okay. Must have been a Republican. Anyway, the thing is that you have to become aware of it. And most people are not aware of it because they're very comfortable in whatever area they're in. And that's ironic. I mean, most, you know, you would think people would always be striving for something better, for something unique and so forth, but not if they're used to a certain way of living. If they're used to a certain thing, they can resist. I mean, we would say, I just got back from China, and we would say probably that, okay, a flush toilet is much better to have than those squatters, you know, you know, just a hole in the ground. But they still in the bathrooms in Beijing, now that they're getting more money and they're putting more Western things in, they still have to put some of those in because people resist, or they have to put signs up. I thought it was really funny. You see these signs warning people not to stand on the toilet because they're still trying to squat, even though they're standing on a regular Western toilet.
Oh, yeah.
And people have been known to fall and break their heads open in the stalls.
I've seen those signs. They're first time I saw it, it was hilarious. But then I understood what they're doing exactly. They're just following old habits. Anyway, go ahead, Mike.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, but most people find a comfort in following an old habit, in doing a routine, in not questioning too much. They may question a little, but usually when it comes to American society, for instance, it's like, well, is it Coke or Pepsi? You know, is it Walmart or Target? That seems to be the level of questioning that's really promoted in American society today. Not is our system the best system, or is there something better? Or should we be worried about the people that control us? Or maybe I should be skipping the nightly news and instead listening to alternative media. You see, this is something that is a process. It's still yanking people out of the matrix and exposing them to a different way of life, which it's that reminds me of Plato's allegory of the cave. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, what happens? The guy, isn't it that he gets resistance from the people that are still in the cave? I mean, they become violent. You know,
exactly. Yep.
He's trying to give them a better life and saying, hey, I've seen something. You need to see this. And they're just like, no way, dude. You're crazy. Sit down and enjoy the shadows on the wall, because that's what life is.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think it was a combination. First, or, you know, maybe at the same time, you've got to become aware, and then you have to get connected to other people that share your beliefs.
Yep. Same analogy in the Matrix, too, by the way, that those people are still plugged in and enslaved by the systems are the potential, enemies, really, that will turn against you to defend, themselves against you, because you're trying to liberate them from the very system they're enslaved in. They might not be interested at all in seeing that bigger world, of course. But following on that, Mike, let's talk about the myth of democracy and the greater good general concept that most people kind of accept some of these, you know, standards of you know, well, it's, you know, whatever, Western values today, I guess. It's transformed over the years, of course, which is another entirely different question. But again, predicated on our sense of goodness, equality, these are issues that most people today, unfortunately, don't argue with, but when they swallow that pill, if you will, they actually, there's a lot of other things that comes with that. We can even see this in foreign policy of the West now, too, that they're trying to sell, you know, democracy to other parts of the world, but it's very violent, it's very intolerant of you know, diverse political systems, etc. So a lot comes in this package of equality and democracy and everything else. What would you say about that? About how the psychopaths have manipulated these systems?
Well, I think generally you have to look at who's behind the systems, and ultimately what the agenda is behind whatever political thing is going on. I mean, if we look at the Arab Spring that took place, what is it now, 4 years ago?
Something like that.
We had a situation. Well, I think it's in America. It was symbolized. Wasn't it? There was an ex-CIA analyst who protested at a Hillary Clinton speech. And all he did, and he was an elderly guy. He stood up and he turned his back to Hillary when she was talking about how social media and all these kinds of factors were really helping spread democracy in the Middle East, and how we needed to really stand behind these people. And he understood, well, wait a minute, this is really not genuine coming from Hillary Clinton. And he was subdued quite forcefully by the security for doing that. And she just kept talking. I mean, it did not faze her a bit. Now, if I'd been speaking and some elderly guy was being wrestled to the floor, I would stop and like, well, what's going on there, or mm-hmm. something.
Yeah.
She just went on like it was blue screen. This was not really there, you know, and she just kept on. And of course, I also remember her laughing when, you know, reports came in about Gaddafi getting killed and so forth. You find that on YouTube, you know, just look up Hillary laughs at Gaddafi's death. But the thing is that during the Arab Spring itself, that there was rebellions throughout the entire Middle East, ultimately. And in one situation, you had Libya, in which if I remember right, the reason why the West totally freaked out was because there were some armed individuals who tried to storm a ammunition depot or something in Benghazi. And of course, Gaddafi sent troops there to stop them, and probably some of them got shot. West was outraged. You know, there has to be some democracy. We need to do something about Libya. In Bahrain, on the other hand, there was a rebellion, but the difference was that in Bahrain, the government, I think they have a military base, a United States military base, and the government's really pro-Western. So there was nothing really said to chastise what was going on in Bahrain. Any more than today, when we see a situation in Yemen where the government of Yemen is faced with a rebellion, and so they call on Saudi Arabia to come and bomb Yemenis civilians who are rebelling against the government. Yep. And no one seems to notice that, you know, that there's a certain irony that Gaddafi, maybe there were several people shot when, you know, someone was storming government offices, which I would say what would happen in Washington, D.C. if the same thing happened there. But yet what I would call the neocon purveyors of democracy today, I have that in quotes as well, they'll set a certain standard for the countries that don't fall in line with United States, English, and French foreign policy, and those who do fall in line. If you fall in line, you're fine. You could be the most despotic country on the face of the earth, and yet, you know, you're okay. But if you're just, you know, you do something negative in any sense of the word, and the U.S. has decided it's time for some regime change, then you're suddenly, you go from being, we work with you, to the next day you're Hitler.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they did to Saddam. Saddam, before the war in 1991, he was seen as, you know, he was buddy of the United States. You know, everything was really great. And then all of a sudden, you know, the war breaks out, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, you know, the new Hitler of the Middle East. And you're like, well, wait a minute. Last week he was our friend. So that's a problem I have with a lot of the people that use the word democracy nowadays. It's selective. And it's also, it just seems to be more of a way of, it sends a message to the masses. When you say democracy, they get this image of, yay, you know, you say dictatorship, or even we use the word regime, and people start thinking of guys on big brick walls reviewing the troops going by in a military parade.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the way it is.
Sure.
I mean, it's an image. And most of us work on caricatures. We work on images. If someone says communist, we think of a communist as, again, someone standing up there in the middle of some big red square, and they're reviewing the missiles going by, and you know, they got these really big, tough bodyguards that are ready to send you to the gulag. They don't think of someone in a nice Armani suit who, you know, is very charming and may have an agenda that's just as authoritarian, but they dress nice. So no, he can't be that way. He sounds nice. He talks nice. He can't be against democracy. But, you know, we think in these kinds of terms, and that can be used against us. You know, a good marketer. I mean, I saw this, and we can go on something different. Maybe, I don't know, but I once went to a trial in which this woman had been accused of helping her boyfriend kill her daughter and disposing the body. And what was interesting was her defense lawyer had dressed her up to look like she just stepped out of the set of Little House on the Prairie, made her look so innocent and really tried to play up on the innocence thing. But it's an image, you know, it's all part of this. Okay, well, I want my client to look innocent and non-threatening, so the jury will get those good vibes, those good emotions, and feel that maybe she was a victim rather than a perpetrator. She was eventually convicted. They saw past that. But, you know, we see that all the time. In media, the words that are used, the images that are used, the words that are not used, you know, just mm-hmm. it's all a play on our minds.
Well, exactly. And it's the terms kind of have changed to and they're so hyper studied. And as you said, through marketing focus groups and everything else, they realize exactly what to say, how to change the words they apply to it. But one of the things I've been thinking about as well, connecting with this, is what some of the values are underneath everything. I mean, I think it was recently Professor John Mearsheimer, who actually wrote the Israel Lobby with Stephen Walt. He commented on the Ukraine situation and said that he said social engineering is where the West tries to topple governments around the world that are not pro-American. And the automatic follow-up question that I had to that is, okay, you know, define these days also pro-American or even those American values that today are forcefully, in most cases, promoted upon other countries so that will give up their own sovereignty, what have you. It might sound good to people who, for example, are in the West and they say, well, what's wrong with that? The equality and justice and, you know, these kinds of issues. But you have a whole game going on underneath here. You know, look at the success of cultural Marxism within the West, for example. So people can't be shallow or superficial if they are to understand the deeper kind of geopolitical game here. And they have to, I think, ultimately just ask, what does it mean, and look beyond the terms and the words that are being used, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. First, on your first question, I would say that nowadays, ideology is dead. No one cares about ideology anymore. That you could say that's so 20th century. What really defines a nation now as being pro-Western or pro-American is how it relates in a business sense to the United States and also some of the nations in Europe. And so if they're willing to do business and to maintain the status quo, then they're allies. They're people that can be counted on. It doesn't matter what their ideology is. It doesn't matter how much human rights they really have. Those are things that can be ignored. Or if you're angry at a country, you can choose something about its human rights and really blow it out of proportion. I'm not taking a stand one way or another in regards, for instance, to Russia's laws that they had on homosexuality, where they said that the law banned any kind of like presentations to people under 17 in regards to homosexuality. And the West really jumped on Putin, especially during the Olympics a couple years ago. However, I just wondered, well, wait a minute, what do they do to gay men in countries in the Middle East like Saudi Arabia and yeah. Pakistan and allies of the United States? What do they do there? Why isn't there any kind of protest about that? I mean, there's some real brutality that takes place. And whereas if someone wants to protest what's going on in Russia, they have every right to do so. But it seems weird that it would not gain any media traction in regards to what's going on in these other countries in regards to freedom and so forth. The same can be said about Iran and Saudi Arabia when it comes to their human rights records. I mean, I think Saudi Arabia compared to Iran looks like, you know, some sort of hippie commune or Jeffersonian democracy or something compared to Saudi Arabia. But yet when something happens in Iran, you get the, oh, look how horrible and barbaric they are. But if someone gets beheaded in public in Saudi Arabia, it's sort of like, there's no coverage. Sometimes there's a couple of newspapers in Britain that cover it, but you will never see any coverage in the United States on these kinds of issues.
Well, they're fully under control. They're in line with the globalist plans, and therefore there's no reason to turn against them. But who knows? This is the other side of it too. Just like we saw the shift in Iraq or in Libya, for example, that when the time comes, these are the things that will be used against those countries if and when that time comes, and they'll turn in a heartbeat. And we gotta watch out and be more clever than that, right?
Yeah. Well, if you see a situation take place in which I don't know, if Saudis would decide not to use the U.S. dollar as their currency for oil exchanges, and we're starting to convince others to do likewise, well, they'd be committing the sin of Gaddafi. And I think there'd be repercussions in the West. And most people don't realize that. Most people don't look deep enough into what's going on in foreign policy issues. They look at it still in a black hat, white hat sort of way. And unfortunately, since most people do trust their government leaders, even though they may gripe about them, there's ultimately this trust factor that takes place. Look at Obama when he was running against Romney. Romney was ahead in the polls. Then that hurricane took place. And then Obama rushed and got some pictures taken with Governor Christie, which made him look like he was out there doing something. And people were like, yeah, he's doing something. And enough people shifted their votes and voted for Obama. And he won the election. Had it not been for the hurricane and it had not been for Governor Christie, he probably would not have won re-election. Mm-hmm. But people like that image. They want to see the person out there. I suspect that if George Bush had been smarter and went down and actually been, you know, gone down to Hurricane Katrina, he couldn't have done anything. I mean, it wouldn't have made any difference, but it might have been enough that, you know, maybe the Republicans wouldn't have taken such a hit and John McCain would have been president. Hey, but maybe it's probably a good thing John McCain didn't become president, if we see how he likes to rattle his sword nowadays.
Oh, man. So, yeah, just if he'd – we'd be – or America would be in Iran probably already by that stage, you know. So
we might be living the Walking Dead, but it'd be radioactive instead.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, these are really kind of, these are 101 points, really obvious kindergarten stuff almost for us who are kind of in the, you know, alternative media, but the masses who vote and ultimately enable and allow these politicians and psychopaths, and marketers, corporatists, globalists, what have you, to kind of just continue. I mean, they're not seeing through this, and they're not doing much about anything. Sure, we could argue that, it's changing a little bit, but ultimately, the bigger question is how to reach out to people, have them understand these things, and think about the bigger questions. I feel very frustrated many times that some of the most basic fundamental points that we almost leave out of the discussion because they're so obvious are still not, understood by the majority of people out there.
Well, you got to remember when you switched. I mean, to a large degree, it's like a religion. The America, there is a religion. I'm not talking about when it comes to Christianity or Judaism or something like that, but we hold our worldview as close to our hearts as we do our religion. And so an American's worldview is predicated on, well, we're always doing right. And for some strange reason, every time we get involved in a foreign policy issue, we're the good guys, which should get people to question just right there. You know, why are we always the ones in the white hats? I mean, what predisposes us to be, smarter or more in line with God than anyone else? But you got to remember, there was probably a point in your life, and I'm sure everyone listening can think, where they were going along with what the society said, what the narrative was. And then something happened to kind of shake that up. Now, some people I've heard, that it was when they joined the military and went off to Iraq or Afghanistan and suddenly saw how things really operated. Then they come back and they're like, their whole worldview is totally shifted. I think a lot of men that went to Vietnam, the same thing happened.
Yeah.
With me, for instance, I remember when I was in high school or maybe just out of high school, and someone told me something that the CIA had been involved in the LSD phenomena. And I just thought, what? Are you kidding me? That would be illegal. Why would they promote something? Why would they be doing something with an illegal drug? I mean, if someone did that, that would be grounds for being arrested. It was kind of that naive way of looking at. And then I started kind of looking at the issue. Things just kept popping up, and I thought, wait, they were involved in these things, and then that helped in kind of getting this image that maybe there was a little bit more to the story. And then you start investigating other issues. And, you know, you just keep finding things. At first, they sound really bizarre. They sound like there's no way that could be true. But then when you actually look and see, for instance, let me give you an example. There was an article in a British newspaper. I can't remember which one. It was a Telegraph or the Independent. I don't remember which. But anyway, and it was about the CIA being involved in the modern art, the popularization of modern art during the 1960s and 70s. Now, I looked it up, and it just sounded like, okay, well, I've found other things. I started looking like, hey, wow, they were. The thing is, if you're just looking at that and you're just a regular person and you read that, you're going to be thinking, oh, give me a break. You know, come on. How would that benefit the American foreign policy? So you see, there's those things where we still have to remember that, and you've probably found this. You tell something to someone and they're going, no way, that can't be true. And then later they come back to you and say, wow, I looked into it. It is true. See, that's the thing. It's almost like a conversion. People have to start understanding how it works. I mean, it's like telling someone that, I found this myself. When you started looking into politics and seeing that, wait a minute, psychopaths do very well in the political arena. They do very well. And you're thinking, well, wait a minute. My image of a psychopath was someone who's in their mother's basement clipping out newspaper clippings about murders and rapes and stuff like that. And then you actually look into it and you're thinking, wow, I mean, why isn't this more known? See, it's another example. We need to expose people more and not just stay in our own little circles. We need to kind of chip away and say, hey, did you know this? And, you know, don't hit them right over the head with, you know, something that's really complex, because they will shut off. They will totally, totally shut off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's like if you, I don't know. I mean, I've seen debates over, you know, when the Noah movie was out it was last year. And there was people that were really griping over some aspects of some people saying that there was high technology in civilizations that existed 10 and 15,000 years ago. But you say that to an average Christian and they're like, whoa, wait a minute. No. Because all their images is, you know, this guy, you know, some guy that looks like Santa Claus dressed up in a Bedouin outfit, you know, and gathering some animals on the boat. And then they'll say, no, it was just this guy and he did this and he had two of every animal. And say, no, it was seven. And they're like, where does it say that? You know, and they're like freaking out. And you say, well, it's right here in the Bible. And they're like, hey, wait a minute. And then they get this really strange look on their face because they've always been brought up with a certain narrative. And once you start cracking it, then you can put more things in there. Otherwise, they're just going to go on their merry way. And it's like elderly people. Elderly people still have that newsreel attitude towards life. You show them something in the news and say, hey, look at this. And they still believe what they see on TV. They believe, well, if it's on the nightly news, whatever nightly news, whatever network, it's got to be true because otherwise it wouldn't be there. And so if Brian Williams says something, it must be true. Well, the thing is that you've got their cultural exposure has been such that it's very unlikely you're going to cause a conversion in them. On the other hand, younger people are going to be more open. And that's where really the alternative media has grown, is people that I would say at the oldest, Generation X, Millennials, Gen Y, but baby boomers, they're still going to be, you know, they're going to be trusting the general cultural narrative. So ultimately, the computer and all these kinds of things, you can open the world up to people. The unfortunate thing with the internet is, you know, I saw something that said something. What was it? It was the internet has made smart people smarter and dumb people dumber.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, so that's a challenge.
It sure is. And most people are living a lie. It's just complete fabrications. The more you look into certain things, you just understand it's a complete bubble artificially created, obviously down for control purposes. However, once things start to get out there, though, these people are on some tremendously shaky grounds. And if some of these items become more widely known, there's going to be a lot of angry people out there. But Mike, maybe we can talk more about that in the second hour. I also wanted to ask you actually a bit more about the low birth rates in the West. We have some interesting things we wanted to get through, go over on that note. But let's talk about your website a little bit more and give us the details about where people can pick up your books, Mike.
Okay, well, best thing actually is you can go to my website again, michaelcross.net, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, cross.net. And, you know, you'll see things I've written there, but also there's a section on published works. And so you can see all three of the books and eventually four here soon. And if you want to catch some of, you know, I have a show, I have my own alternative news spot. It's called Unlock the Door Radio on UCY TV Productions. And so you can go to my YouTube at Michael Cross. Just type that in and you'll find most of my shows I convert over into YouTube videos so that they, you know, reach a higher audience. And I deal with all kinds of stuff, whether it's, you know, social, political, psychological. A lot of stuff on psychopathy, some famous psychopaths that I've interviewed. Their interviews are on there. So, yeah, just either come to my website or go to my YouTube station and you can pick up a lot. And my books, you can just go to Amazon. That's probably the easiest. Just type in Freedom from Conscience. And, you know, the three titles are Freedom from Conscience, Melanie's Journey, Freedom from Conscience, Melanie's Awakening, and then the third book is Freedom from Conscience, Deliverance from Evil, and the fourth will be Descent into Darkness. So, but yeah, Amazon's the easiest place to pick up the copies, either on Kindle form or in paperback.
All right, very good. MichaelCross.net is the website. We'll take a short break here, folks. Stay with us, Mike, and we'll be right back with more. A very interesting second hour is coming up with Mike Cross as we talk about the declining birth rates, population decline, overpopulation, resource depletion. We discuss the United Nations approach to this issue with suggestions of replacement populations or replacement migration into all countries where European people live and have settled. We speak about why women in the West are having fewer children. What is the reason for low fertility rates in Europe and other regions? We also talk about the superficiality of the political campaigns, politicians, and of course how the media is losing credibility all the time. People's distrust of the media is an all-time high. No wonder about that. We also speak about Edward Bernays, the architect of the consumer mind, and how we've gotten lost in the superficiality of materialism as opposed to encouraging eternal values that are for the preservation of who we are. Don't miss the second hour coming right up as we proceed. If you don't have a membership yet, you can acquire one at redicemembers.com. Sign up for a 3-month recurring or non-recurring subscription to try it out. You'll get full access to all our previous programs and all our video material and everything else we have for you. It is well worth it, and at the same time, you support independent and censored media. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back with the second. Talk to you on the other side of the break.